Okay. Today is March 6th. It's our second class this semester. I've already gotten emails from a number of people. People are not with us now, so I know people are listening. And next week we'll meet as well. It's on the Shushan, it'll be after Shushan Purim, so that's fine. I have a lot of interesting things to talk about today. Really interesting with Rav Harlap, but even before we get to that, let me share some other relevant matters, which I think you'll find of interest. A couple relate to what we did last week, and some are new. First of all, if you read the Sforim blog, you know that this new book of over 800 pages, like 860 pages, just came out called The Gedolim, which is a book of really what we're doing. Books, it has, looks like 20 different articles on great rabbis. My article is on the Stipler of Kanievsky, and the article came out of these very classes. I find that quite interesting. And this was a conference about 4 or 5 years ago, and now they finally published the proceedings. Just as a side point, I'll tell you, because I'm going to write about this, but you might find it interesting for me to tell you right now. The Stipler, if you recall, if for those who are listening now, live, or others, if you remember the classes, he was very opposed to what we call mechkar, analysis, philosophy, things like that. He believed in what they call an emunah pshuta, simple faith, without getting into complications, and he didn't even believe in attempting to refute the irreligious, because he thought that would raise issues in the mind of the religious that maybe be problematic. So a simple, what they call a muna tamima, muna pshuta, something like that, as opposed to those who believed in studying philosophy and things like that. The Stipler also didn't want to reprint medieval philosophical texts. So if you look at the titles of all the articles, they tried to give each one a special title, a title relevant, like not just the name of the person. So the Haposek Hador, that is the decisor of the generation, and all sorts of interesting titles. So what to call my article, because I didn't give it a title. I just called it Rebecca of Yisrael Kanievsky, the Stipler. So the editor, Binyamin Brown, Benny Brown, he suggested to call it Hatamim, because that really, what does the word Tamim mean? If you're from Chabad background, you know Tamim is what they refer to all the Chabad yeshiva students. But it also has the connotation of pure and complete and not you know, damaged at all, unblemished. And in rabbinic literature, that is used not just to also refer to individuals, that they're complete. First of all, it's used in the Torah, tamim tiyen, things like that, to mean, you know, have perfect faith and not be involved in other, you know, idolatry and superstitions, things like that. But it also is an adjective to refer to people who are also like that. People have, like, simple faith. So that's the title we gave it. Now, lo and behold, I knew this, but I didn't really pay it much mind, because I think it's obvious. It's obvious to anyone who reads the article that that's the meaning of Tamim that I'm using. There's a Mechaber Sefer, an author, I mean, he said that this is a perfect description of the Stipler, you know, Tamim, that without getting involved in, you know, all these other matters, just simple, pure faith. The problem is that the word tamim, in, I don't know if it's modern Hebrew, or but it's definitely modern yeshivish Hasidic type of lingo. The word tamim means unsophisticated. Now, how the word tamim means unsophisticated, I don't know. I've done a little investigation, and I've spoken to people about this, learned people, and no one can tell me that anywhere in rabbinic literature the word tamim means that. Tom, the word Tom, does mean that, but not Tamim. In fact, someone, a very learned person, sent me from a Sefer, which is not that long ago, a Sefer from the 1980s, in which the author is bemoaning the fact that the word Tamim for the masses has begun to mean the same thing as Tom, that it's begun to mean unsophisticated, when of course it doesn't at all. I have the sefer right here. It's called Shulchan Shlomo. Not an important sefer, but this he knew about this. Okay, so then they have this Otzar Chachma forum where the the from academic types and the more the traditionalists, they have all sorts of discussions. So once you know it, someone picks up on the title and accuses me, and then I got other emails from people wondering about this because this is very widely read. You know, what is it? How could I have the chutzpah to write an article and in the article refer to, you know, the Talmud as if I'd write an article and refer to this great rabbi as the simpleton, the unsophisticated one? Quite apart from the fact, why would anyone, certainly not me, why would anyone spend a lot of time writing an article and delving into someone if they thought he was unsophisticated and not worth it? But so here you have an example of where a kosher term, tamim, a really a good description, because of how in the modern slang it means a simpleton, they have these people going around saying that the article that I published in the title, I'm calling him the stipler is a simpleton. So that's that was interesting this week. Other things, we had classes, three or four classes on Rav Yosef Messas. Lo and behold, wouldn't you know it, Tokfo Shel Yosef Messas. A whole book came out just last month in Shvat on Yosef Messas. And who wrote it? None other than Rabbi Chaim Amsalam, who's the troublemaker for the Shas Bardi and the Haredim. And I was quite surprised from reading that, you know, he only discovered Rabbi Messas a few years ago. He didn't know about him, but he sees Rav Yosef Messas as the example of a tolerant Sephardic Jewry. So in addition to the polemics he has against the Haredim, the Ashkenazim, and the Sephardic Ashkenazi wannabes, he presents Rav Yosef Messas as the model for rabbis today. And as I said, we had classes on him. And finally, in terms of books, I picked up this book this week. We also had classes on Rav Shach. So this book is called B'sarat Eish, about Rav Shach. So why did I pick it up? There's so many of these books that I can't get all of them, but this book was controversial, I heard. There's been talk about it on the various Israeli websites. So of course, it's controversial. I want to get my hands on it before it's banned or, you know, if they don't reprint it again. It's controversial for a couple reasons. First, there's anti-Chabad stuff, and there's stuff opposing protests, which would be seen today as a repudiation of what's going on with the more extremist Haredim in Israel today. But what I found interesting is that since we just finished the classes in our Rishis Zalman Meltzer, in the introduction, they quote Rav Shach as saying that he heard from Rav Yisrael Zalman Meltzer that when Rav Yisrael, well, he was there, Rav Yisrael Zalman Meltzer heard a story about a great rabbi, and Rav Yisrael Zalman Meltzer said he doesn't believe it. And they said, you know, the person who told it said it happened with him, and Rav Yisrael Zalman said, then you can be sure it didn't happen. And why is this story being told? Because the author said he asked Rav Shach, you know, in these classes here, everything I try to do is truthful. Sources, and some of you are always emailing me for the sources, but the author of this, who was like a shamash to Rav Shach for decades, he says he once asked him at the end of the day, what's the big deal if the stories are not true or not? So we tell stories that aren't true. How is it any different than the Magid? The Magid gets up and tells a mashal, a parable, it's not true. And Rav Shach replied that, but if you're going to teach people how to live based on these stories, they have to be true. Of course, my problem is I don't know how many of these stories that are true. For instance, there's a famous story of Rav Chaim Moser Grzinski, which is attested all sorts of places. That Rav Chaim Moser Grzinski said that when he was young, the most important thing for him was to write a sefer, a book. But as he got older, he realized that, you know, helping widows and orphans is more important than writing Sfarim. And that story is quoted by all sorts of people. And Rav Shach himself, in at least two separate places, quotes this. Now, in this book, we're told the Rav Shach said, at least he told this, his shamas here, that really he doesn't believe that Rav Chaim Ozer meant this. And that it's really, he didn't really believe this. Why am I telling you this now? Because remember last week, I told you that when I was in yeshiva, that they didn't let us do chesed. Because our time is supposed to only be in learning. And here he's told, Rav Shach is saying that he doesn't believe that Rav Chaim Ozer really meant it. He just was saying it so that people would know that it's important to help others. And then he cites in the book that there is someone who wanted to, he was in yeshiva, this is on, if you want to check it out, page 200, and he felt bad that he wasn't doing any chesed. So every now and then he thought that maybe he'd go to the hospital. He knew how to play violin, and he played violin for the patients there. And Rav Shach said to him not to go, and that you can do chesed in the yeshiva by helping people who don't learn so well. So here you see also another example of, no chesed. Okay. And no chesed outside the yeshiva, I should say. Okay. Like I said, I have a lot of interesting things to do with Rav Chalap, so let's get right to it. But before we do, just one more thing, because I've heard there's a rabbinic expression, ha'ikar chasar min ha'sefer. The main point is lacking. And I went through this whole thing last week about how to pronounce Evan Ha'ezel, Evan Ha'azel. Afterwards, I went online, and I was surprised, because when you Google it, I was surprised to see that just as many people call it Evan Ha'ezel as Evan Ha'azel. There are people who call it Evan Ha'azel, just as many, as I said, including well-known people like Rabbi Bleich and others. So I was of the opinion that that was the standard way, and I was telling you something novel, but lo and behold, if you Google Evan Ha'ezel Meltzer, you'll see that plenty of people do know what I said, that it is true, that it should be called Evan Ha'ezel. So what do I mean when I say the main point was lacking? Because unless you took the classes or a bit of a rabbinic scholar, you haven't heard of Evan Ha'ezel, Evan Ha'ezel. But most Jews, with any learning, have heard of the Shulchan Aruch, and the third order of the Shulchan Aruch is called Evan Ha'ezer. So this is what I forgot to mention, that... And if you look in Tanakh, if you look in Shmuel Aleph, Perek Zayin, what does it say? It says Evan Ha'azer. But it also says in two other times in Shmuel, in Perek Dalet and Perek Hey, Evan Ha'ezer. It's the same thing. Evan Ha'ezel, Evan Ha'azel, Evan Ezer, Evan Ha'azer. It's the same exact thing. There's no one in the world who says Evan Ha'azer, because everyone knows, or should know, that... When the only time you'd say Azer is when it's an etnachta in the middle of the sentence or at the end of the sentence. Well, it's the exact same thing. There's Ezel and then there's Azel. And therefore, just like no one says we're studying Evan Ha'ezer, you should not say I'm studying Evan Ha'azel. And I have to say I was a little surprised that Rabbi Bleich, who's very learned, gets this wrong. And then I'm sitting in Shul on Shabbos and we're reading the Torah, Parshas Truma. And lo and behold, what does it say here in the Torah, in chapter 25, in the same pasuk, you have, it says, Kaftor v'farach, and it also says Kaftor v'farach, v'farach. That's a famous sefer, or Shtori HaParchi, dealing with Atlantic laws in Eretz Yisrael and other things. And again, no one's going to say that the name of the sefer is Kaftor v'farach. The name of the sefer is Kaftor v'farach. It just, at the end of the sentence, you say Farach. So next time you hear anyone say Evan Ha'azel, or let them know that it's not. It's Evan Ha'azel. Okay, back to Rav Chalap. Lots of interesting stuff. Today we're going to really get into also the dispute. Rav Chalap plays a vital role in the great dispute over Rav Kook that breaks out in the 1920s. But let's first continue with the biography. Rav Chalap is appointed, when he's 28 years old, appointed Rav of a neighborhood in Jerusalem called Sha'arei Chesed. If you look on the map, you'll see where Sha'arei Chesed is. I'm not exactly sure. I think, if I'm not mistaken, it's not far from Machane Yehuda. I'm not very good with the geography in Israel, in Jerusalem, the different neighborhoods. I walk and I find them, but I don't have to take a map out. But that's an area. That's the area Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach lived and other people. And this was a new neighborhood. built outside the city walls. Most Jews, when this was built, were still living in the old city walls. 1909 is when they start building this. And he was appointed the first Rav of the Shaarei Chesed neighborhood. And he's Rav there for 42 years until his death in 1951. In the early years of being a rabbi there, the relationship between his master, Rav Kook, and the other rabbis, the more extreme rabbis, was actually very good. Rav Kook was in Jaffa, which was a new settlement, people who came over from Europe, and the rabbis in Jerusalem and Tiberias, the old-fashioned rabbis, they had no connection to these new Jews. They couldn't speak to them. They were, culturally, they were a completely different group. So they were actually very happy that Rav Kook was there, and he was able to, be a rabbi for them the way that the old-fashioned rabbis could not. And the more traditionalist rabbis were surprisingly even willing to support Rav Kook in some of his ventures. The most famous one, I think, is that Rav Kook, when you think of Kirov, I know today we think of Chabad, or then later we can think of the Lithuanian Kirov, but make no mistake about it, Lithuanian Yeshivish Kirov, when does that get started? In the 70s? 80s, maybe? It was not an issue at all, and it wasn't on the agenda. Probably it only comes on the agenda either because of seeing the great success of Chabad, or it could be that many people, finishing yeshiva in Kollel and yeshiva, and they really didn't want to sit and just learn in Kollel. That wasn't what attracted them, and they wanted to do something related to Torah, so this then became an option for them. I mean, Rav Shach himself says that Kirov should only be for those people who can't make it in yeshiva, who can't handle it, and at least this is better than just go out and having another job. But he did not see this as a positive thing for, as you could say, the best and the brightest. On the contrary, however, the American Rosh Yeshiva came to see it as something that even the top people should be involved in. But if you ask yourself, who is the first person in Jewish history who takes an active role in Kirov, I have to say, I think it's Rav Kook. Now, I know Chabad likes to claim, with maybe some justice, that even with Rav Kook, you have to give some credit to Chabad, because Rav Kook's mother was Chabad, and that had an influence on him. But I don't buy it, because it's not Chabad per se. Kirov really starts with the Lubavitcher Rebbe, Rav Menachem Mendel. And maybe a tiny bit with his father-in-law, but it's not like Chabad was doing it in the 10s and the 20s and the 30s and the 40s. There wasn't such thing as Kirov. It wasn't on the map for anyone. And yet Rav Kook, that's why this crazy man, Yosef Mizrahi, among all the crazy stuff he said, the most obscene, and which they should never let him get away with because it's blasphemous, is this false prophet. He says and I mentioned this on one of my Sforim blog posts, that the reason the rabbis in Europe were killed was because they were, during the Holocaust, they were not complete tzaddikim. And how do we know they're not complete tzaddikim? Because they didn't engage in Kirov. Like anyone ever thought of engaging in Kirov in those days. And for this phony to refer to all these kadoshim, these great holy people who were killed, as not complete tzaddikim, I mean, that's more blasphemous than any of the crazy stuff he said. I mean, it boggles the mind how anyone could speak like that. About tzaddikim and tahorim. I mean, it's unbelievable. But the whole idea of Kirov didn't exist. Rav Kook, however, starts engaging in Kirov. Let me give you an example. So Moshe says, was she Lubavitch? You're referring to Rav Kook's mother. No, she wasn't Lubavitch. That's also the interesting point. Thank you. She was Kapus, which then becomes Babroisk. So it's Chabad, but it's not Lubavitch. But no, Yisrael, I don't think Hirsch engaged in Kirov. When did Hirsch engage in Kirov? Kirov means outreach to the irreligious. Did Hirsch ever do that? I'm not aware of anything like that. I mean, he wrote, unless you regard the 19 letters as literary texts, which is a text that anyone could read it. But I'm talking about actually going out there. Rav Kook decided to organize in 1914 a Kirov journey to the north. This journey, by the way, of Rav Kook, is actually replicated, I think, now every single year for the last 5 or 6 years, because I was in last summer for the first time. I went to Beit HaRav. If you haven't been to Rav Kook's house in Jerusalem, I highly recommend going. I mean, you could do the whole thing in an hour, and that includes the half-hour movie. But just to see, and that's where the yeshiva was at first. But just to see it, it's really interesting. And they had a sign there for this, you can join, I don't know what month they did it in, but, you know, they go visit the places that he went to. He went up to these kibbutzim, these secular, I don't know if secular is even the proper term for that. Secular implies basically you're neither here nor there. You don't have any strong commitments to religion, and you know, these were not just secular, although their lifestyle was secular. These were anti-religious places. These were people who were literally rebelling against traditional Judaism. So it's very different than the typical secular Israeli today, who just really doesn't have any interest. There was an ideology here, early Zionism. And Rav Kook organizes a Kibbutz journey to go to a number of these kibbutzim. And so, you know, they were anti-religious, but they all had come from religious backgrounds. And they saw Rav Kook as a different sort of rabbi, so they were willing at least to let him in and talk to him. And he goes up, him, Rav Harlap, some other rabbis, including Rabbi Zonnenfeld of Jerusalem. Rav Zonnenfeld, who, you know, is portrayed as an extremist and does have extremist tendencies, no question about it. He isn't an extremist to the extent when you think Satmar and others, whose attitude to the irreligious was completely negative, and they didn't want them there and wanted nothing to do with them, wouldn't even talk to them. Rav Zonnenfeld was willing to be involved in this mission and went to the places, and they danced with the Jews there. I'm going to read you actually a little description of it in a few minutes. And it's important to mention Rav Zonnenfeld, especially because we're going to see the feud that begins in a few years. And it shows you that Rav Zonnenfeld was willing to work with Rav Kook and was willing to go to spend time with the irreligious. Sure, at the end of the class, I'll get back to what you're saying. I see it's an interesting point, so we'll talk a little more about that. And I'll read you in a few minutes a passage of where Harlapa describes this Kibbutz journey. World War I, of course, starts in 1914, and it leads to a great change in the land of Israel because the British, you know, the British, we look back... Jews look back to the British as their role in the land of Israel as not a good thing, and that they refused with the white paper, refused to let Jews into the land of Israel. Once the 40s begin, well, really already in the 1930s, the British determined that their interest, despite the Balfour Declaration, their interest was with the Arabs. There's a lot more Arabs. The Arabs have the oil. And they went from being pro-Jewish to being middle of the road to really being pro-Arab. And there are plenty of examples of where Arab marauders were attacking Jewish places and Jewish convoys. And the British really, they stayed out of it. They stayed in their bases, refused to come out. After all, they until May 1948, they were running the show. And therefore, as running the show, they had a responsibility to protect the citizens, and they refused to. They, for the last couple of years, they knew they were counting their days down. They remained in their bases and really didn't do anything to help the Jews. And therefore, the Jews needed the Haganah. Why do you need a Haganah for? You need a Haganah precisely because the British were not doing their job. So we looked for. I mean, we don't have a very good feeling. And if you haven't been to the prison in Akko or in Jerusalem, where you can see where they hung Jews, I mean, it doesn't leave a good taste. We sometimes forget, I think, or people forget, that when the British came in, they were viewed as liberators. They were viewed as, I won't say messianic or even quasi-messianic, but they were viewed as, I guess, paving the way to the messianic era, even by some religious people, because this was viewed as a civilized country. Country now with the Balfour Declaration that's going to allow the Jews to, you know, be in charge of their own destiny. And then when the High Commissioner, Herbert Samuel, was appointed a Jewish High Commissioner, that was so symbolic of the Jewish return to the land of Israel. So everyone was pro-British, and the Jews had fought on the British side. There was a Jewish brigade in World War One. The Ottomans, the Muslims, the backward country that was, where you couldn't get anything done without bribery, and here the British come in. So we have to remember that there was a lot of good as well. And one thing that always struck me, though, is with all the bad feelings for the British, and when the British finally left, there was a feeling of good riddance, they never changed King George Street. You would have thought they would have changed that. The same feelings about the British, when I was in India, you know, everyone talks in India about, you know, the importance of nationalism and kicking the British out. But one of my guides said that, you know, they really go overboard because, you know, we really need to be thankful, he said, to the British because they brought in, you know, court systems and proper schooling and all sorts of things. And then he said the most important thing, they brought in the English language. The fact that English language is spoken by hundreds of millions of people in India economically has meant a great deal. So, during World War One, as I said, you had Jews fighting in the army. And then the war ends. And there are now chances to create a whole new system there. A chief rabbinate, was set up by England, and changes in the yeshivot, all sorts of things. You had Jewish philanthropists in England, including from the Rothschild family. There was one in particular, James Rothschild, and others, who thought that they were going to civilize the Jews, the old-fashioned Jews of the Yishuv HaYashan, the old Yishuv in Jerusalem, just similar to what Jews felt they were going to do to the Jews of Poland during World War One, and the German Jews thought they were going to civilize them. Rav Charlap, as one of the leading rabbis, there weren't that many rabbis in Jerusalem at that time, he responded to this, and you can actually see a book came out on him in the 40s, it's called by Shabtai ben Zion Don Yechia, called Yaakov Moshe Charlap, and on page 33 and on, you see Rav Charlap, standing up for traditional Torah study. We oppose all changes from the outside. Kabbalah B'Yadenu, we have a tradition, how and what way to learn, and at the yeshiva and the Talmud, etc. It's interesting because Rav Kook, his yeshiva that will be later established, was not afraid to adopt some changes. This James Rothschild suggested that yeshiva students should also enlist in the army, namely the British Army. Jews had made such a good impression in World War One. Since this is now part of the British Empire, Palestine, everywhere the British went, locals enlisted in the army. That's how they controlled India. There was like 50,000 British in India, a country of hundreds and hundreds of millions of people. But they were able, because of so many different groups in India, they were able to enlist in the army all these groups. And then if one group rebels, they still have all these other groups in the army on their side. And this was very important in World War II, because Britain had a huge amount of manpower from all its colonies. So James Rothschild suggested that he was in Palestine, and you had these wealthy, influential Jews from England, some of whom were Zionists, others who were not Zionists and opposed the Balfour Declaration, but now that Palestine was under British control, they wanted to have an influence in it. And he suggests that the B'nai Yeshivot should l'hitnadev l'tzava, to volunteer for the army. But remember, this is not a Jewish army. This is a British army. What you're going to hear Rav Charlap say, and what Rav Kook said when he was in England as well about yeshiva students going to the army, these were later quoted in 1948 and afterwards to show that even Rav Kook and Rav Charlap do not believe in yeshiva students going to the army. But Ratz Yehuda Kook pointed out that you can't draw a parallel between going to a non-Jewish army and a Jewish army. Yeah. But what does Rav Charlap say? Rav Charlap says that he values the army is very important. He spoke very, this is page 37, how important the Hatzara, the declaration that's referring to the Balfour Declaration is, that we haven't heard this, he says, Apayim Shana, 2,000 years, Jews haven't been told they can return to the land and be in charge of their own destiny. I mean, the Balfour Declaration is just what is it, two sentences. His Majesty's government views with favor the establishment of a Jewish homeland in Palestine. Maybe one sentence. That's pretty much the wording of it. Sir Kharap speaks about how viable it is, and he says that those soldiers who fought Mohammed's mitzvah, this was a great thing, but they, you know, they have to remember those who were in the army to keep kosher, all those sorts of things. But then he says that there are two gedudes, two brigades, I guess that's good translation. There's the physical brigade, which is, you know, very important, but then there's the gedud HaKadosh, Ha'omei B'Bayit Hashem, at night and at day, and it's important that the Kol HaTorah not be removed from the Gedud B'nei HaYeshivot. He says, each one of them has a job to do. Chas v'chalila, Hasira Me'al Mishmar Tama Kodesh. And it goes on to say that his words had an impression on James Rothschild, who agreed to stop any pressure that the yeshiva students should be making a contribution. You know, the Jews wanted to show that they were contributing to Britain. So you see that Rav Kharap does say, and he's going to say as well, that even Rav Kook, that, you know, there are certain yeshiva students, not all yeshiva students go to the army. It should just be a blanket exemption. Hold off on that. World War, during this period, Rav Kharap's master, Rav Kook, is not in Israel. He's stranded in Europe. Later I'll read you some of what Rav Kook writes. I'm going to tell you what Rav Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg writes, that he was, the letters of Rav Kharap to Rav Kook made him nauseous. Spiritual revulsion, that was his words. So what would have made him, you know, spiritual revulsion? I think what made him is some of the fawning way that Rav Kharap is so, I don't know an English word for this, but he or Mavato himself to Rav Kook. I don't know of anything of Rav Kook. And I think that debased himself in that. Kharap writes to Rav Kook when Kharap is in Switzerland and England. It boggles the mind. Once the war ends, this was the Sephardic Rishon LeZion, but now it's a new era dawning. And that's Rav Kook's father-in-law, Rav Shmuel David Rabinowitz Teomim, was brought in to be. So they first want a rabbi of Jerusalem, and all the institutions and the yeshivas pretty much turn to Rav Kook and ask him to come. And shortly following that, he's then elected chief rabbi of the country. Nevertheless, even though everyone knew that Rav Kharap was so attached to Rav Kook, and they saw that Rav Kharap wanted to help bring Rav Kook in as Rav of Jerusalem. If you look at the list, I've read it to you in the past, of all the institutions, you're talking about the major yeshivot of the Ashkenazim, in fact, all the yeshivot of the Ashkenazim, and the important families, from Tukhachinsky, the Auerbach family, Yeshivat HaMakubalim, Yeshivat Meir Sharim, they all sign these declarations, which are printed in the letters to Rav Kook, asking him to be the Rav of Jerusalem. The extremists, this small group of extremists, which we're going to talk a good deal about, because only a few years ago, two amazing letters of Kharap were published dealing with these people, but they came up with a plan. They came from the same background as Rav Kharap. The plan was, make Rav Kharap chief rabbi of Jerusalem. Because if he's the chief rabbi of Jerusalem, for the separatists, that is, for their community, And they thought that that would, you know, create a break between him and Rav Kook, and they could offer him a very nice salary. This isn't the first time they tried this stunt. There was a great rabbi who had extremist tendencies, but he was a Lithuanian, which is unusual, and he came from Volozhin, and he was quite close to Rav Kook in Volozhin, but he later adopted extremist views. His name was Rav Zelig Ruvain Bengis, a big, big Talmud Chacham. So the extremists wanted him also, but he refused to take the position as long as Rav Kook was alive. Because although he actually shared their ideology, he knew Rav Kook as a tzaddik, and he was a friend of Rav Kook. When Rav Kook passed away, then he took the position as like head of their Beis Din. But they actually came up, although it was a non-starter, let me read you here, they came up with this idea of asking Rav Charla to become chief separatist rabbi, because these people were not going to accept Rav Kook as the rabbi of their community, so they needed a competing rabbi. And these were the people who would be called, who were in the Turei Karta. This is on, you can find discussion of this in the book Shira Tayam on page 337. And it describes there how Rav Charlap had like no money. And they were willing to offer him a lot of money, but as he explained, if you separate yourself, he quotes something that Rav Tarfon said to Rav Akiva, if you separate yourself, you know, from the master, it's that you're kaparish min ha'chaim, it's that you're separating yourself from life. So he refused to do that. The Haredim were more successful in recent years, I mean, the extremists. Rabbi Moshe Sternbach, they were able to get him to join their group, and he seems to be okay with that. All he had to agree with was that his children, I think it was his grandchildren by now, they couldn't go to the Beis Yaakov. His children could have gone, that was different, but now if he's the head of the Eda Haredit, then, in their schools, they don't learn Hebrew, and it's very different. The same thing happened with Rav Avadi Yosef. They wanted to create the Sephardic Eda Haredit, but he refused to go along with that. Then the great dispute happens. Rav Kook comes to Jerusalem, comes in 1919. Shortly during Orot is published. Orot is the first, it's not the first book of Rav Kook, but it's his first Eretz Yisrael, I guess you'd say, theological, philosophical text. The followers of Rav Kook, and the books he had before were, we had Arpilei Toar, which was never actually published. They embargoed it before it got out. You can read about that in my recent book. He had his halachic work on Shemitah, Shabbat Haaretz, but this is really the first work where you get Rav Kook's ideas, and it's the first Eretz Yisrael work. The followers of Rav Kook always make a distinction between the Chutz La'aretz works and the Eretz Yisrael works. And following that, you have a number of other works, also Orot. Orot HaKodesh, Orot HaMuna, Orot HaTshuva, but this is just Orot. This is the first. And for many people, this is what gives them a religious Zionist ideology. And if you've never read the book, I highly recommend it. Some of the passages are just so, what can I say, they really carry you away with them in his insight and his feeling and just his outlook. Today maybe doesn't strike you as so unusual because you've heard all this, but you understand where he's coming from. And an enormous feud breaks out, because if he was still in Yafo and this is published, so they would have opposed it as well. I mean, but he wouldn't have been so significant. Now he's the head of, he's the Rav of Jerusalem, which means he's in charge of all these institutions, that is the spiritual head of all these institutions. And soon he's the chief rabbi of the land of Israel, which means he has a lot of influence with the High Commissioner, with the British and everything. So an unbelievable dispute breaks out. I don't want to get into too much detail now. I will in a little bit. I mean, we've spoken about this dispute numerous times. Why is it relevant to us now? Because Rav Charlap is front and center. He publishes a book. You can see it in HebrewBooks.org. This is where I printed out from. Tovim Me'orot. It's a michtav. It's not long. It's a, you call it a kuntres. It's, let's see here. Yeah, it's 14 pages. So Rav Kook writes Orot, and enormous dispute breaks out, and which Rav Charlap, as we'll see, is brought into this dispute. And Rav Charlap writes Tovi Me'orot. So let me talk about this book. I'm going to speak a little bit later about how Rav Charlap is brought into it. And here I'm holding a text. This becomes the classic text of the extremists. It's called Kol HaShofar. It's a little booklet, historically very significant. Everyone talks about it. The problem is you can't get it. HebrewBooks.org refuses to put it up. I've sent it to them over the years like probably five times. Why won't they put it up? Because it's defamatory. It defames Rav Kook, it defames Rav Charlap, and they don't want to do it. Otzer HaChachma won't put it up either. And yet I tell them, I try to tell them at least, it has to go up. This is a very, very important historical work. This has the Cheirem against the Orot, signed by Rav Zonnenfeld and Rav Diskin. This has the attack on Rav Charlap. Look, I don't like that. I don't want to attack Rav Kook and Rav Charlap, but that doesn't change the fact that this is an unbelievably important historical document. All the discussion and the conflict that breaks out refers to this. The rabbis of Europe refer to this, and you can't get it. I got a copy because the Satmar publisher, 20-some years ago, let me see, no, how many years ago is this? I was in graduate school in 1990. So you're talking 27 years ago, a Satmar publisher reprinted some of these booklets. But if I wasn't able to get it, I don't know. I mean, I haven't been, it's not online as far as I can tell anywhere. I looked for it. So I made a PDF of it myself. If anyone wants it, I can send it to you. It's not a perfect PDF because the copy here of this one is not perfect. But I just sent it the last week to Otzer HaChachma at HebrewBooks.org. If I recall correctly, we're taking back right at the beginning of HebrewBooks.org. When it first began, it was just books for American rabbis, and then they expanded. I actually wrote a... he had me write a, haskaman or an approbation or something or another, a text about the significance of HebrewBooks.org when it was all about American rabbis, like three paragraphs, which was supposed to be placed right on the website, attesting to it. But then he saw that, why just make it American? Make it for everyone. And now there's like some 70,000 svarim. If I recall correctly, it was put on one of the times. He didn't realize what it was, and he just put it on. Just like early on, HebrewBooks.org had Karaite literature and all sorts of stuff without knowing what it was. Over time, people would tell him, his name is Chaim Rosenberg, people would tell him, this is not good, take it off. That's my recollection, that at the very beginning of the HebrewBooks.org, he did have the Kol HaShofar up, but it's not up there anymore. He also had Shaul Lieberman's works on it. But that he had to take down because of copyright violations, which I understand. So what precipitated Rav Charlap writing this? You see it right in the introductions. It was published by a guy named Isaac Ben Tovim. So we say Tovim Me'orot, although we say Tovim Me'orot Shavar Aleinu, it's an expression, but it ties in this man's name Tovim. I don't know why he got a name like that. It must have been a different name in Europe. Tov is Gut. So Gutson or something like that. It must be Gutenson, which becomes Ben Tovim. Like Guten Tag becomes Yom Tov. So in the introduction is this, from this Isaac Ben Tovim, says that he got the Sefer of Orot, and he found paragraphs in it, sections, which he doesn't understand, and, leave room for criticism, and in particular, chapter 34. we do, what's so problematic with Chapter 34. Really, without Chapter 34, I don't know if there would have been this dispute on Orote. They might not have liked it, but Chapter 34 was, it's like giving, you know, sharks blood. They wanted something to destroy Rav Kook, and he gave him something that all they had to do was twist it a little, and, you know, lie a little, and they were able to get to the result. As Rav Harappel described, they were able to get to the result they wanted to. And as Isaac Ben Tovim says, even though I, you know, I'm sure it's because I am weak in knowledge, he says, that's why I don't understand, you know, what Rav Kook is saying. He refers to, you know, Rav Kook as Rabbeinu HaKohen HaGadol Ish HaShkolah Er Doreinu. I mean, he thinks Rav Kook is the greatest sage, but he says, I don't understand how he could say this. Therefore, I turn to you, and because I love Rav Kook, and I don't want to leave questions on it, and since I know that you are so close to Rav Kook, I turn to you, Rav Harlap, to explain to me how Rav Kook could say the things he did say. And that's how someone with kavod, when you deal with a great Torah sage like Rav Kook, if you have a problem, and this is what we'll see Rav Harlap says to these rabbis in Europe, when you deal with a great Torah sage, if you have a question or a problem, you approach him. And you ask him to explain it. You don't put him under a ban or put the book under a ban. That's not how normal people act. So that's what he writes to him. And let me read you now, to remind you, for those, or to teach you, for those who don't know, what Chapter 34 of Orote says. I'm reading you from the translation of Orote by the greatest Rav Kook scholar in the writing in English, Bitsalo Naor. He even has a website, orote.com, where you can see all of his writings in Rav Kook. You can buy all of his writings, and he has some of his writings on there. This is only English, and has an amazing introduction of like 60 pages dealing with the dispute over Orote. And it just came out last year in Hebrew English, but nothing else really has changed in it. So let me just read to you Chapter 34 in Orote. For some people, this chapter is what allowed them to connect to Judaism in a way they never could. And it showed them that Judaism has a future in the land of Israel, and that we're coming to the land of Israel. We're not just bringing the Golos and recreating the Golos of Europe in the land of Israel, but we're building a Torah society with a whole new outlook, because now that we're returning to the land of Israel, we have to live differently than we've lived for the last 2,000 years in the Golos. And we're not going to be a weak people stepped on by, the Polish peasant and, the Russian lords, that we're going to stand up for ourselves. So for some people, this was the most incredible thing. For others, it was also an incredible thing, but incredible that it was shocking, because how could a rabbi, someone who studied at the great yeshivas, someone whose job it was to pass on the Torah, could say this. Okay, hold on to your seats. Chapter 34 of Orote, in the wonderful translation of Bitsalo Naor. The exercise that Jewish youths in the land of Israel engage in to strengthen their bodies in order to be powerful sons to the nation, that is the nation of Israel, enhances the spiritual prowess of the exalted righteous, who engage in mystical unifications of divine names to increase the accentuation of the divine light in the world. So in other words, the exercise that these Jewish youths, the ones living on these kibbutzim, the non-religious, the anti-religious, what they're doing, their exercise, that assists the pious ones who are engaged in Kabbalistic things to help bring divine light to the world. Then he cites some psukim, how David made a name, David performed justice for his people, Yoav was over the army. The point of this is to show that these great sons of our people, King David, they weren't just involved in Torah study and things like that. They were out there in the world building armies. If youths sport, that is, if youths are involved in physical activities, to strengthen their physical ability and spirits for the sake of the nation's strength at large, This holy work raises up the Shechina. That is, these Jews exercising this raises up the Shechina, just as it rises through songs and praises uttered by King David in the book of Psalms. In other words, you have some people reading Psalms, Tehillim, but what these guys doing, their exercises, strengthening their bodies, that raises the Shechina just like people reciting Psalms. Through the supernal Kavanot, the inner soul rises. And through actions that strengthen the body of individuals for the sake of the community, outer spirituality ascends. So you have inner spirituality and you have an outer spirituality. Both together round out the orders of holiness by making more pronounced the character of the nation. And then he quotes the Pasuk, in all your ways know him. That is, you have to know God in everything. You know God intellectually, you know God spiritually, you know God physically. When you work out, work your body, we're not talking people who are working out so they could be in the Olympics, lifting weights. We're talking people working their bodies out so they're strong, so they can work the land, so they can defend the Jewish people, so that they can once again reclaim the idea of strength, which used to be a Jewish value as well. Physical strength combined with spiritual strength until the non-Jews removed us from planting, from agriculture, from armies, from anything, and forced us just to have spiritual, intellectual strength. But we're supposed to have everything. We're supposed to be complete people. We're not supposed to be cut off from the physical, which is what we were for so long. And that's the importance of the non-religious, because they have the physicality, which we don't have. And therefore, we need to take, they're going to provide the physicality, we provide the spirituality, and we can create a new Eretz Yisrael Jew, which is really, we say new, he's new now, but it's really, this is the old way of doing things. When Jews lived in the land during the times of King David, that will have spiritual strength and physical strength. And then he goes on, do not be astonished if there are shortcomings in the way of life of those engaged in physical and terrestrial strengthening in Israel. Don't be astonished. I mean, you look at them, they don't do this anymore, but even on Rosh Hashanah, they didn't fast on Yom Kippur, but I don't know if they did any, like, sports or anything, but Rosh Hashanah and all the holidays, they would have these like games and everything. Don't be astonished by that, though. For even the manifestation of divine inspiration, Ruach HaKodesh, requires clarification from the admixtures of impurity that seep in. Yet it becomes increasingly purified, sanctified, and refined. Redeems itself from exile until it becomes the path of the righteous. So even Ruach HaKodesh has negative things in it that have to be pushed out, like dregs, I guess, you have to push them out. So too, these people, you look at them, you see their lifestyle, it's not in accord with the Torah, don't be astonished because that's only temporary. You know, they're going to, that too will be purified. Everything in the land of Israel will be purified. Some need less purification, some need a lot more, but everyone is moving in the right direction. The direction of purity, of holiness, etc. This was just too much. To compare these anti-religious settlers who were creating their socialist utopia and were creating a society, not just a society, you know, where they were not so religious, we're talking about a society where as a matter of a shita principle, they didn't want religion. They didn't want the rabbis who were old-fashioned and they were rebelling against them. To say that these people, the exercise they're doing, the physical strengthening they're doing, and the physical strengthening even that the religious Zionists are doing, that that's equal to people sitting and reciting Tehillim? That was too much. How can you compare that to... Now, he doesn't say equal to reciting, to learning Torah or anything like that. He doesn't even say equal to learning Tehillim. He's saying simply the recitation of Tehillim. But that still was too much. So what does it mean? What does Harab think it means? How can this be justified? And the whole idea, the whole theology of a rote, that you know, have this dialectic, that you have the irreligious who have what to give to the religious, and the religious have something to give to the irreligious, and we're going to create this new synthesis of a new type of Eretz Yisrael Jew. I mean, how is that acceptable? Because the irreligious, we're going to take from the irreligious, we should be rejecting the irreligious. And here Rav Kook is saying that now the irreligious has to have an important role to play. As I said, this is just too much. We have to talk, so what does Rav Kook explain? if he wasn't in their crosshairs before, when he publishes this, he's in their crosshairs, as I'll read to you. But let me read to you about how Rav Kook understands this. Rav Harlap. Because for Rav Harlap, everything that Rav Kook says is not just holy, it's holy of holies, Kodesh HaKadoshim. Even the thought, even the Havamina, the thought that Rav Harlap would imply criticism of Rav Kook is impossible. He related to Rav Kook, not just like a Rebbe in Lithuanian Yeshiva. Rav Kook is a Hasidish Rebbe, a super Hasidish Rebbe. There's no possibility of even raising a doubt on anything Rav Kook says. Everything is holy of holies. So what to do? So let me read you some of what Harlap says, and Rav Harlap goes with it all the way, and in one or two passages it might even seem that Rav Harlap goes even more extreme than Rav Kook in this new theology. They don't think it's a new theology. It's a new theology in that it's being stated now, but it's not new. Everything it comes out of the sources, the Torah sources. What's new is that finally Jews are in control of their destiny and are given the chance to once more create a complete Jewish people. So that's why the ideas sound new, but they're not new. We're living like King David lived and things like that. So he says, let me read you some of what, summarize for you, some of what his explanation. He specifically mentions the megama, the point of Perek Lama Dalit. And he says, this is in pages, I have selections of it here, beginning on page 7. Doesn't everyone know Godel Hatzarach, the great necessity for Gevura, Gam HaGufanit, Vagad HaNevuah? Harlap says, first of all, everyone knows that in order to get prophecy, you need to have physical strength. This is his reading of Rav Kook. Rav Kook, there's no reason to think that Rav Kook's mention of physical strength has anything to do with prophecy. That does not even seem to have anything at all. It's almost like Rav Harlap is reading Rav Kook in a completely different way, but that's Rav Harlap's interpretation. He says, first of all, you wonder why Rav Kook focuses on strength. Don't we know? And he quotes the Gemara, Eina Nevuah Shara El Al Gibor Chacham Anavashir. The only people who can get Nevuah, one of them is a Gibor, a strong one. So you need strength. So how could you criticize, working out and being strong? So new, in the Chutz Aretz, no one had any expectation of prophecy. But now that we return to the land of Israel, we have to expect that there's going to be a return of prophecy, and therefore we need to train people for that. The problem was that Rav Kook wasn't speaking about the religious people doing this, or the yeshiva students. He was talking about Dafka, the secular types, who are doing the Gevura, and that's what they're going to get. But that's what Rav Harlap says. And he says, we need this. We were called upon now to prepare ourselves to reach the levels of Ruach HaKodesh and Gilui Eliyahu that we look for. And therefore, in this right now, Hinenu Nidrashim Leyot Shleimim B'chol HaTanaim Echad Me'em Lo Yechaser, because we have to be complete in every aspect. So that's an important point also. Leaving out the Nevuah and everything else, Harlap is saying, as we're going to this era, the Messianic era, which he expects is coming soon, we need to be complete. In other words, the traditional Jew in Eastern Europe is not complete. It's like a half Jew. It's missing a very important part, which is that's how we had to live in the Golos. But that's, we no longer have a connection to the land. We no longer have a connection to physical labor. We no longer have a connection to physical strength. That means we're not complete. We're missing something. We're defective products. Now that we're returning to the land of Israel, Rav Harlap is explaining, and this is authentic Rav Kook, that we need to be complete. Rav Harlap adds to that as well that completion is also necessary for prophecy and for Ruach HaKodesh. And hey, maybe Rav Kook also had that in his mind, because let's not forget, it's not just that the irreligious are creating themselves physical. They are giving that to us as well, because we're lacking that. So us Torah students and Torah scholars, we are going to be getting that physicality, and that will enable us to, you know, reach higher levels. Oh, I see it's already 10 o'clock, so there's a lot more to do. And Rav Harlap, we'll see, has his own theory, which is not in Rav Kook, explaining what evil is. And wait till you see them go to town on Rav Harlap in this, in the and then enter the Gerer Rebbe. The Gerer Rebbe will come to Jerusalem to try to make peace, and that is what this interest of the Gerer Rebbe to somehow make peace is the impetus for two unbelievable letters from Rav Harlap dealing with this dispute. And then, oh, we have a lot to do. We are just getting started. So let me take, if you have any questions. Let me make a note of where we stopped here. To pick right up next time. Okay. I had said that I asked about Kirov with Shimshon Raphael Hirsch. So Yisrael points out most of the students in Hirsch's school for East Europeans were not from or not fully from. He also ran around Frankfurt going to non-from homes looking for students in his school. I'm not sure what you mean, his school for Eastern Europeans. What school? He didn't have a school for Eastern Europeans. He had a school in Frankfurt, which East European kids could attend. Okay, if you say that a number of them were not completely observant, Hirsch's school was never exclusive for members of his community. It was, for all of his Austrit, he allowed, that was only on an institutional basis, but for his kids going to the school, anyone could come in. So I guess you could say that that's a form of Kirov, I guess. Okay, I accept that. Hirsch should get credit, really, for starting day schools. Let me tell you another pet peeve of mine. You'll appreciate this, I think, Yisrael. I can't tell you how often in the last few months, talking a lot about, you know, women's education, rabbis and everything, and everyone's talking about, you know, Sarah Schneier. That, you know, if Sarah Schneier, who started Jewish education for women, if it wasn't for Sarah Schneier, you wouldn't have had Jewish education. It's as if no one knows that in Shimshon Raphael Hirsch's day school in the 19th century, you had women's education. He's the one who instituted women's education. Enough with the Sarah Schneier already. It's only because the people in Eastern Europe were so backwards when it came to girls. They didn't teach them anything, and a whole generation of girls were lost who became totally irreligious. It's because of the foolishness and the kozmainess of Eastern Europe that you needed a Sarah Schneier. But to make believe as if she started Jewish education, you needed her precisely because the people in Eastern Europe were screwing it all up. But Hirsch in the 19th century had already seen the significance and the necessity and created this, and Sarah Schneier didn't come to it on her own like she had a prophecy or anything. She was reading Shimshon Raphael Hirsch. And when it came time to establish the Beis Yaakov, what does Sarah Schneier know to do about that? They bring in Leo Deutschlander and German Orthodox people to help her start this thing. So forget it that Sarah Schneier started Jewish education for girls. Shimshon Raphael Hirsch started Jewish education for girls. So, I mean, he should get the credit for this. And he started the day school movement and all that. So, yes, if you're going to say that that's a form of Kirov, I accept that 100%. I didn't know that he went to non-religious homes looking for students and trying to encourage them. So there, I will say that maybe Rav Kook is the second well-known rabbi to be involved in Kirov with Shimshon Raphael Hirsch as the first. Now, you ask, was the average Jewish shtetl really so physically weak? No, you know, we have to speak, we're speaking in terms of types, you know, Platonic types here. You're always going to have, Jews had to do labor. I mean, they weren't sitting at desks like we do today. So you had plenty of Jews who were strong, who were doing labor, but let's not, you know, had to pull carts of food and things like that. But let's think of what it was like for many. Who were the most important Jews? The scholars, the rabbis. They never did physical labor. They became weak looking over books. In fact, the Jews who rebelled against the Torah, they portrayed the scholars as the weaklings, looking over the books. So the fact that you're going to say that some uneducated person is lugging bricks around to make a living and he has strength, that doesn't mean anything. Because who are the who's the salt of the earth, to use that New Testament expression? Who are the important people in the community? The important ones, the ones that everyone wants to be like, they're the rabbis and the scholars, and they were the weak ones. And they were the ones who had nothing to do with what we're talking about because they were with the books all the time. And also, who were the wealthy ones? The wealthy ones are the ones, the merchants. So those are the leaders of the community, the merchants, the rich people, the rabbis. None of them had any connection to this sort of physicality that when you come to the land of Israel, when you come to the land of Israel, for these pioneers, lugging bricks around and digging ditches, that's not something which you give to the people that because you don't want to do it. That's something that it's a zechut. Everyone wants to do it. The irreligious. And that's also so important for Rav Kook because that explains why these Jews are regarded as so different than the irreligious in other countries. Because here, instead of going to Paris or America or South Africa, instead of having a good life and trying to make money, they are sacrificing the best years of their lives to go dig ditches and to drain swamps and deal with these marauding Arabs. They didn't need to do that. The fact that they were doing that, so yes, they say we're doing it to build a society and a non-Torah society with a new approach, but yet they were serving Torah and serving Eretz Yisrael without even realizing it. They have a special segula, and the proof of this is look what they're doing. They're not coming to America or England. They're going to live a very difficult life, trying to get rid of malaria swamps, all in the name of Eretz Yisrael. So that's the significance there. Yisrael says the Volksschule. The Volksschule in Frankfurt? I don't even write. I know the Art Scroll book. I don't even recall it. You're saying that there was a special school for East Europeaners who came in? There weren't that many East Europeaners in Hirsch's time in Frankfurt. There were hardly any. The East European immigration really comes in the 20th century. By the 1920s, early 1930s, you had an enormous East European Jewish population called Ostjuden in Frankfurt. But in Hirsch's day, how much did you have? I'll get back to you on that. In general, you didn't have, you had a very, very small East European Jewish population in Germany in the 19th century. But I will check it. In fact, in the 20th century, the wider community, not the Hirshian community, the larger community, has East European Dayanim brought in to run everything. Yisrael says, plus Sarah Schneer was inspired by her purchase rights. Yes, actually, I didn't even see you write that. And that's what I said. And in the first Beis Yaakov in Krakow, they read Goethe, they read Schiller. It was a complete German Orthodox curriculum. And it was put together by this man, Leo Deutschlander, who comes from Germany. And so, as I said, enough with saying that Orthodox Jewish... How many times did I say Orthodox Jewish girls' education was started by Sarah Schneier, as if Germany didn't exist, where Hirsch starts a whole... has a day school for girls. Yisrael says, in bringing back outlooks from olden times is what the Hasidim did by bringing back mysticism, or if Hamburger is doing bringing back Minhag Ashkenaz. The difference is Rav Kook is going back thousands of years, and maybe that's part of made it too hard for others to accept. The change was too much for them. Would you agree? There's a difference between bringing back a Minhag and davening, a few words, and changing the entire Jewish lifestyle. What Rav Kook is saying, that our whole lifestyle needs to change. That yes, Torah study is important, but there are other things that are important. And he's also accepting the irreligious as having something to contribute. All these are going to be problematic. Okay, I'll look on page 220. In last summer, I was in Frankfurt, and I went to where the school was, the Hirschian School, and all these things. But I didn't go to the Volksschule because I read the book, so I knew about the Volksschule, but I forgot all about the Volksschule. So let me take a look at that, and I'll bring it up again the beginning of next class. Okay, for all of you who are with us tonight, one more question, and then we'll go. How did their relationship play out in practice? Did they talk often? Did they study together? Did they live near each other? Did Rav work on projects for Rav Kook? Stay tuned. All of the above. Okay, good night, everyone. See you. Have a happy Purim. See you next week.